Lecture 42, Alexander the Great.
Welcome back again. If you remember last time, I'm afraid I ended on a little bit of a down note. It was the end of the Egyptian dynasties. It was the end of Necténabel II, the last native ruler of Egypt. And it is a bit sad. It's the end of a great tradition. But I don't mean to suggest that it's the end of great people and great history in Egypt. We still have great characters coming. Alexander the Great, we'll talk about him today. We've got Cleopatra, we've got the Ptolemies. So don't be depressed. It'll be okay. Let me remind you that there was a tradition. You'll remember that Necténabel II had fled Egypt. And there was a tradition that I mentioned that it's a legend, the medieval romance of Alexander, that says that Necténabel, disguised as an Egyptian magician, went to the Macedonian court and took residence there. And he bedded Olympias, the wife of Philip II. And thus, Necténabel is really Alexander the Great's father, right? So it's so if you really were depressed at the last lecture, you can always think, well, here comes another Egyptian, Alexander the Great. But it's, of course, just a myth. Alexander is a Macedonian. He's Greek. Now, Alexander's career really falls into three different sort of parts. It's Alexander as a general, Alexander as Pharaoh of Egypt, and then Alexander the Great, the legend. Let's start with Alexander as a general. Philip II, his father, king of Macedon, was assassinated. Alexander's approximately 20 years old, and he takes command of the army. They are, of course, battling the Persians. And Alexander, even as a young boy, was loved by the soldiers. They would follow him anywhere. And he takes up his father's battle, fighting the Persians, and defeats Darius at Issus, defeats the Persians. And with the Persians defeated, where is the place that he goes? Egypt. Egypt. It's where Napoleon said all great men have to go to begin, right? And Napoleon was, of course, following in the footsteps of Alexander. Alexander enters Egypt. Now, he doesn't enter it as a conqueror of Egypt. I think he really must have been entering as a liberator. You know, remember those stories of Herodotus and, you know, Cambyses and what the Persians had done to the Egyptians. The Egyptians must have been relieved. Here comes somebody. Now, Alexander enters with a different mindset, a different attitude from the other foreigners. Remember, he's Greek. And how did the Greeks view Egypt? They revered it. Remember, Herodotus and everyone else is saying, we get our culture from Egypt. Greeks wanted to be like the Egyptians. I mean, in a sense, you know, this is 332 BC, but the Greeks are now Johnny-come-latelys. They're new on the planet. You know, Homer is only constructing his Iliad and Odyssey around 900 BC. So the Greeks are newcomers, and they love to be associated with the Egyptians. So Alexander enters Egypt, and in a sense, he wants to be Egyptian. Now, when I say he wants to be Egyptian, he wants to be an Egyptian pharaoh. Why? Because the Egyptian pharaohs were the only rulers who were gods. Right? There's a sort of step up for any ruler to be pharaoh. Remember, other foreign rulers tended to rule, you know, from the palace in Assyria and Persia. He comes into Egypt. Now, how do you become a god? Right? What is he going to do? Well, there are three events that take place in Egypt with Alexander. We are not 100% sure of the order in which they take place, but the three events are: he goes to the Siwa Oasis, and I'll talk about that one first. He is crowned as pharaoh, and he establishes Alexandria, the city. Okay? But let's talk about Siwa. Now, why go to Siwa? Let me describe Siwa. I've been there many times. Wonderful place. Wonderful. It's an oasis. Lush. Green. Different from any other place in Egypt. Quite different. It's so remote, though, It's only 38 miles from the Libyan border, across the Libyan desert. Far away from the Nile, far away from the big cities of Memphis, Thebes, isolated. It's so remote that up until fairly recently, the inhabitants of Siwa, of this oasis, didn't speak Arabic. Now, the Middle East speaks Arabic. These people spoke Berber, language of the nomads, right? And Berber is interesting, by the way. If you look at the numbering system of Berber, I remember kind of reading a little book on Berber, trying to get some idea of how the language worked, because I spoke Arabic, but not Berber. Their numbering system is 1, 2, 3, many. They don't have a number for 4, 5, 6, right? It was very remote. And what they use today in Berber, of course, they pick up the Arabic numerals. They use, they say 1, 2, 3, Arba, which is 4, Khamsa, which is 5. They're using the Arabic numbers. But this place is really remote, really remote. Why is Alexander going there? Because at Siwa is an oracle. Now, remember we talked briefly about oracles? There were oracle statues in Egypt. These were statues that supposedly could talk. You could ask it questions. Remember, one oracle even solved the mystery of the stolen shirts when a workman had slept during noon and the shirts were stolen. The culprit was brought before the oracle, and the oracle said, yep, he did it. So oracles were statues. But this is a different kind of oracle. This is an oracle who is a priest at the temple of Amun in Siwa. Remote, remote. Now, this priest could tell you things that couldn't be known by natural means, in the sense of a clairvoyant, a prophet, that kind of thing. Now, during Alexander's day, oracles were acknowledged. The oracle at Delphi, for example, was a very, very important oracle. You would go there, and it wasn't just consulted by the old women who believed in superstitions. Kings went to the oracle before battle to ask, will we be successful? And at Delphi, for example, you would bring an offering, a goat perhaps. And depending upon which way the goat would bleat, it was like, yeah, or yeah, whichever way, then you would find out if the oracle would answer your question. And then you would give the offering, always an offering. And then the oracle would answer. This was that kind of oracle at the Siwa Oasis. And Alexander was going to cross the desert to see this oracle. Now, he is going to ask it only one question. The reason he's going to the oracle is he wants to be declared Pharaoh of Egypt. And you have to be a god. And he's going to ask the oracle the question, who is my father? Now, of course, it's Philip of Macedon, we know that. But the politically correct answer from the oracle is going to be the son. Remember, every pharaoh, as one of his names, had Sa-Re, son of Re, in front of it. Right? So every pharaoh was viewed as the son of the sun. So Alexander wants to be declared Sa-Re, so to speak, son of Re. That's why he's going to Siwa. Now, according to the tradition, Alexander and his men were lost in the desert. Now, remember, this is not surprising. Cambyses lost 50,000 men in the desert, and they still haven't been found. Someday, mind you, someday I mentioned that a friend of mine is just cranking up for an expedition using remote sensing devices from planes, from low-flying aircraft that will detect metal. And if you have 50,000 swords there, you're going to find this lost army of Cambyses. But Cambyses lost 50,000 men, and Alexander knew that tradition, but he was crossing the desert. And according to the tradition, legend we have about Alexander, he got lost. And the men were dying. And they saw crows, black crows, that led them to Siwa. They followed the crows. Now, this sounds a little bit sort of hokey, a little bit mythological, but it's not quite so crazy. If you're in the middle of the desert, crows don't necessarily live in the desert. They're going to go to where there is food. Not unlike Noah's Ark, and seeing the dove, and yes, there's land somewhere, and the same way navalmen, you know that land's new, you see birds. So they follow the crows into Siwa. And when Alexander entered Siwa, it must have been like a paradise. It's green, lush. It has pools bubbling up, dates hanging on trees, you know, just idyllic. But Alexander didn't come to eat the dates. He came to see the oracle. Now, the temple of the oracle is high on a hill. Very impressive sight. It's in the middle of Siwa, above the tree line. You can look from a hill all the way down, and you see the temple. It was the temple of Amun, right? The most important god in Egypt during the late period, Amun. But during Alexander's time, when Alexander was brought there, he's working through an interpreter, undoubtedly. He was told it's the temple of Zeus Amun. See, they're making it sort of comprehensible to Alexander. Amun is Zeus, Amun is Zeus, so it's Zeus Amun. And again, remember, the Greeks said, oh, we get our gods from the Egyptians. This wasn't anything new to Alexander. So Alexander is taken to the temple. He approaches. We don't know exactly what he saw. He would have certainly brought an offering, something like a goat. And he probably wasn't permitted to enter into the Holy of Holies, the innermost recess. That adds to the mystery. You know, those priests knew what they were doing. You know, they wanted to keep you out, and it was probably incense burning. But Alexander indeed asked his question, who is my father? And he got the politically correct answer, the son. So Alexander, by this revered oracle at Siwa, was declared a god. A god. That's going to be the start of the legend, you'll see. Now, we have two other events in Alexander's career in Egypt. It's a brief career. He's going to leave soon. But the other two events are that he's crowned as pharaoh. Probably in Memphis, that capital city from the days of practically from Narmer. And he wears the double crown. Interestingly, by the way, there is a temple. If you go to Luxor, Egypt, the ancient city that the Greeks called Thebes, the Wasit of the ancient Egyptians in the south, there's a temple built by Alexander the Great. And his name is in a cartouche, just like the other pharaohs. Interesting, by the way, it was a little bit of a problem. How do you spell Alexander in hieroglyphs? There's no X in the hieroglyphic alphabet. So he did it with a K and an S. Sounds right, right? Alexander, right? Alexandros. So there is a temple that Alexander built. But where? Thebes. Sacred Thebes. The one that always held out until those Persians. Right? So he has a temple. But he's declared king and he is crowned as the ruler of Egypt. And this is going to start, by the way, 300 years of Greeks ruling Egypt. But remember, there is this reverence that Alexander had for Egypt. He's not this conqueror who's going to plunder. He's not going to do that. He's going to be Egyptian as much as he can. So we know that he is crowned, probably at Memphis, king of Egypt. The other important event is that he founds the city of Alexandria. By the way, throughout his career, he founded about 12 cities of Alexandria. This is the one that took. Right? This is the one that worked. And there's quite a tradition about how he founded it. You know, we do have historians from the time of Alexander, right? There are historians of Alexander. So we're getting closer to modern times. We have some records. And we know the name of the architect, Dinocrates. Right? He had his Greek architect. And they laid out the city together, walking the land. Now, let me say something about Alexandria in ancient times. There had been quite a bit of excavation in Alexandria, Egypt. There have not been ancient cities found from pharaonic times. There was not a large population in Alexandria. So view it pretty much as open land. Part of the reason, I think, is, as I mentioned many times, the Egyptians were not good sailors. They weren't having a port ready to go out to the Mediterranean. You know, they didn't need it as a port. They weren't going. They weren't sailing on the Wajwur, the Great Green. So it's an open area. You can pretty much pick your spot and build your city. And he walks the land with Dinocrates. And according to the tradition, they lay out the city. They didn't have chalk. They wanted to use chalk. They didn't have chalk to lay out the streets. They used grain. So they used grain, dropping it along. And they laid out the city's streets. They laid out the city's streets in a grid at right angles. One of the early planned cities in the history of the world, right? To take advantage of the Mediterranean breezes, right? So it's right at the angle, so you get the breezes coming down the streets. And he founds the city of Alexandria and leaves. And leaves. Alexander is going to conquer the world, right? But just remember, Alexander is so different in many ways from Egyptians. He is founding a city, a port, on a port, very Greek. So he's going to be able to do trading. He's viewing this with the future. This is not typical Egyptian isolationism, you know. We're hemmed in by two deserts on one side, a river on another side, cataracts on the other side. Nobody's getting into us. No. Alexander's looking out. He wants trade. This is going to be a great city. And he was right. He was right. He picked the right spot. So he founds Alexandria, and he leaves. Now, he leaves with his army, a large professional army, large, 50,000, 50,000 men. The logistics of an army of 50,000 men is daunting. For example, if you have 50,000 men, how do you draw water from them for wells? You could have as many as maybe a dozen wells, and they'll die of thirst. You can't get enough water from wells for an army this big. How do you feed them? How do you feed 50,000 people? I mean, imagine a large football stadium, you know, a reasonable-sized football stadium, feeding all those people, maybe for months. Can you go into a small village? Certainly not. So to a great extent, Alexander's movements, the movements of his Macedonian army, were determined by where the food was, where the water was. You went to towns that had food. You went to places that had fresh water. At some times, you even had to have ships carrying the water for your men. It's not the way you think, you know, let's go here because it's a logical place to go. No, they're driven by needs. Now, if you were in Alexander's army, you were leaving home for maybe 10 years. Think of that. You know, it's sort of like kiss the kids goodbye for a while. Maybe you're coming back. You were going to march God knows where. Long campaigns. You can't come home quickly. 10 years you were leaving for, perhaps. Very different concept of what time was and what family relationships were. You know, you also get this as late as the 19th century when you read the early travelers to Egypt and the guys who were looking to discover the source of the Nile. You know, they were in this some godforsaken place. They get sick. What do? You wait there for 2 years till you get better. And then you don't go home. You press on looking for the source of the Nile. Different concept. These were people who said, you know, iron men and wooden ships. You know, these were tough people. And along with Alexander's army, 50,000, came hangers-on. People who were going to sell the army things, provisioners, women, right? It was quite an entourage. And they start moving, right? He goes all the way, Babylon, to Susa, to India. India, right? Walking all the way. Incredible, this army. Never defeated. Alexander was never defeated. That's part of the legend. He was a god, and his men believed it. They would follow him anywhere. Now, they got to India. This has been a long campaign. I don't mean to suggest, because you win all the time, it's all roses. It's not. And at India, Alexander wants to continue. Wants to keep going. His men are tired. They say, no more. It's no mas. They don't want to go on. They would like to go home. Right? Alexander relents. And they turn around at India and start the long march home. Now, on this long march, I should say this. Alexander was really a genius of sorts. You know, there is a tradition that Alexander was taught by Aristotle, the Greek philosopher. There's an interesting connection. Socrates was the teacher of Plato. Plato was the teacher of Aristotle. And the tradition is that Aristotle was the teacher of Alexander the Great. And supposedly, when Alexander went on this long campaign, he sent back specimens for his teacher Aristotle. He sent back, for example, mineral specimens. Remember, Aristotle wasn't just a philosopher. He was interested in everything. And Alexander never forgot his teacher, sending things back. But now it's time to go home. And they start the march back. Now, interestingly, the men would have encountered women that they had married. One other thing about Alexander was he felt that to really succeed at taking over a culture, you have to integrate into it. He wasn't this sort of conquer, beat him up. And he had his men marry foreign women. There were mass marriages. Mass marriages. Quite interesting. But they start the long march home. In Babylon, Alexander takes ill. He ran a fever for a considerable time. It sounds like he might have had dysentery, something like that. The way the illness is described, he may have had dysentery. But he lingered a long time, long time. At one point, his generals knew he was dying. And there is a historical account that his generals gathered around him. Now, Alexander had conquered the known world, as we call it, a big chunk of the planet. And they asked him, "To whom does the kingdom go?" And you know Alexander's reply? The fittest. He didn't name a successor. It was going to go to whoever was the fittest, the strongest. So Alexander dies. And the kingdom that he conquered is divided. It's divided. Egypt, the subject of our 48 lectures, Egypt, is given to his general Ptolemy, trusted general, who will later, next time, become Ptolemy the First. But Ptolemy gets Egypt. But Alexander's story is sort of just beginning. His body, now remember, he's a god, worshipped by his men. I mean, when Ptolemy was given Egypt, he wouldn't even rule Egypt. Wouldn't even rule Egypt as a king. Because he thought that maybe Alexander's son would do it, or something like that. Alexander's body lay in state in Babylon for a year. For a year. Now, the reason it's in Babylon is he dies there and they don't want to move it yet. They are bringing in gold and Greek craftsmen to fashion a catafalque in the shape of a tomb to transport the body of Alexander back to Macedon for burial. They wait a year. Now, you might wonder, how do they preserve him? Now, they didn't. They didn't mummify him in the Egyptian way, probably. They wouldn't have had Egyptian embalmers. Right? We know that the body lay in spices, preserved in spices. There's also another source, and by the way, one of the sources for what we learn about Alexander is Suetonius. Interesting source, has some details about Alexander's burial. And one of the traditions is Alexander was mummified in white honey. Don't ask me. White honey. I mean, it sounds like Cairo syrup or something, but it could be that somehow resin was poured over him, maybe somehow, and that might be congealed white honey. It might be viewed that way. But white honey is what they say. And this tomb out of gold is constructed. Right? It has scenes on it in gold of Alexander's great victories. It must have been one of the greatest things ever constructed by man. And it is pulled by a team of mules who have gold bells on them. Gold bells. And the reason they have gold bells is so that as Alexander is being pulled from Babylon to Greece, right, to Macedonia, the towns will hear him approaching and know that Alexander is coming. We even have one eyewitness report, somebody who actually saw it, right? It must have been an incredible sight. I mean, people have never seen anything like this. But as Alexander's procession moves along, it reached Syria. Now, by this time, Ptolemy, the general who had been given Egypt, had taken residence, probably in Memphis, but they're constructing Alexandria, right, the city. He rides out, ostensibly, to see the body of his fallen commander, Alexander. But he hijacks the body. He comes with an army and takes the body back to Egypt. Now, why? Well, one is, of course, Alexander's a god. And by having Alexander buried in Egypt, this is going to kind of sort of increase your prestige of your city. So the idea is, as you're building Alexandria, founded by Alexander the Great, what better thing than to have the body of Alexander buried there? So he takes Alexander back to Egypt. Now, he prepares for him a tomb at Alexandria. We know the name of the tomb. It has a name. It's called the Soma. Soma. It just means the body, as in psychosomatic, that kind of thing. Just Soma, the body. And for years, the body of Alexander the Great lay at Memphis in state while the Soma was being built, constructed. We know the tradition. Alexander was buried in Alexandria. Virtually certain that Alexander the Great was buried in Alexandria. And the tradition is that he was buried at the crossroads of the two main streets of Alexandria. But as you probably know, the tomb of Alexander the Great has not been found yet. The reason is that Alexandria really grew, and it changed. And over the years, the crossroads of the two main streets has disappeared. We don't know what the two main streets were in ancient times. We're not sure. So the body of Alexander has kind of disappeared in history. We know for sure that later people saw it. Later, Greeks in Egypt, ruling the Ptolemies, dug it up for the gold coffin. Melted down the gold and gave him a crystal coffin, they said. So Alexander has been seen after his burial, but his tomb has disappeared. You may have heard in the newspaper reports, maybe 5 years ago, that a woman claimed to have found the tomb of Alexander at Siwa. Now, there is a tradition that Alexander asked to be buried at Siwa also, because the oracle proclaimed him there a god. And this woman working outside of Siwa, a Greek woman, and that's important, I think, she would have loved to have found Alexander's body, claimed to have found the tomb of Alexander. I've been to that tomb. Believe me, it has nothing to do with Alexander the Great. Her translator was her husband, who's a businessman, who's Greek, but not that he reads ancient Greek well, and he did some strange translations of some Greek that says nothing like what they said it was. It wasn't the tomb of Alexander. Everybody agrees now. It was a bit of a hoax, if anything. A bit of a hoax. So the search for Alexander the Great goes on. That is one, you know, often I'm asked, are there any great discoveries to be made? That's one. The tomb of Alexander the Great is still out there, waiting to be found. Some people even think they know where it is, right underneath the Nebi Daniel Mosque in Alexandria. But it's difficult to excavate there. It's a mosque. Can't tear it down. Maybe Alexander's tomb will be found in our lifetime. It's a real possibility. But Alexander starts 300 years of Greeks ruling Egypt. And that's what we'll talk about next time. See you then.